Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting with Ben Harper. And we're sitting across from Tracy Sorensen, who's here to talk about her new novel, Lucky Galah.
Welcome. Hello, Tracy.
Hi.
This is your first novel, isn't it?
Yes, it's the first novel that has been published.
Yep.
So there's a couple in the bottom drawer.
Yeah.
And I think at this point it's probably best they stay there in the bottom drawer.
Well, keep them there because in future there will be academics wanting
okay.
to come look at those.
Oh, well, who knows? Okay. I might burn them, actually. Yeah, but no, it's the first. It's the first published novel for me, yeah.
And what do you do in your day job? You're an academic. What is it? Are you teaching writing? Are you involved in literature?
Okay. Yeah, my day job is teaching at Charles Sturt University in Bathurst. I teach documentary making, journalism, a lot of different stuff to do with the media, communications in general.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this book is, what's the word, unique, I would have to come to. When I started reading it, I found out that it was being largely narrated by a galah. I know now you've got the two manuscripts in the drawer, it makes more sense that someone is working towards such a big leap in fiction. How did it come about that you, fell into the voice of Lucky the Galah?
Okay, well, Lucky emerged spontaneously out of my manuscript as I was writing it. It was just written being, I was writing in third person omniscient, and I was writing about Linda and Evan coming to this small town to kind of play a part in the moon landing, and then they were getting to know the people next door, and those people had a galah in, you know, just outside the back door, and then I just started writing just a section from the point of view of the galah, and I found myself kind of crying. I was really moved by what I was doing.
That's great.
And there was just something unbelievably compelling to me about, just this different outsider voice, this very trapped and contained, poignant kind of little voice, you know, that nobody's paying any attention, but she's kind of noticing everything, and she's also got her own stories to tell. So, yeah, she just became more interesting to me. And I guess she didn't come out of nowhere, because when I was a kid, we did have a galah, you know, out the back door, between the back door and the outside dunny in this small town where I grew up. I guess she just really represents themes of feeling like an outsider and having stories to tell. Yeah.
I feel like I've done it again, because I always jump into the bit that I want to talk about first without really giving anyone, the poor listeners, any idea of what's going on. Can you tell us a little bit about the Lucky Galah set, where it's set? So just a really basic sort of overview. We'll dive in deeper. I've seen I've jumped the gun a little bit.
No worries. Okay, so it's set in the immediate lead up to the moon landing in 1969 in a very small town on the coast of Western Australia, right up the west coast of Western Australia. And these NASA technicians and people have come to town because there's a dish just outside town on the Red Sand Dune that's tracking the Apollo missions and the previous missions, Gemini, Mercury, all those, but culminating in the moonwalk. And so these people have come to town, and there's kind of this expat community of sort of scientists and radar people and all sorts of different people. And there's the machinations of, you know, what's going on in the human stories, which includes things like adultery and, you know, all sorts of interesting human stories. As they work up to the moon landing, and things go very badly for one particular NASA technician, but then, you know, at around the same time, things go really well for the pink and grey galah. So it's the galah's point of view in amongst all this going on.
So having started with a human story, and then wandered and found this other character who started to become a larger and larger voice. Did you despair at any time that that you were wandering away from traditional storytelling, and that you were, it is difficult when you're in this, the throes of creation, to have these things take you off the path, and you're thinking, well, I do want to write, and I do want to get published, and I do want people to understand what I'm doing. Is this a bit crazy for everyone? Like, was it that kind of fear? Because you don't just take it another step further too.
Yeah, it was. It was. It was a huge process, and I understood straight away that this was a risky thing, because I'm there saying to people, I want this to be, well, this is a literary novel, you know, and it's narrated by a galah, so, you know, deal with it. and I knew that was difficult, because of course the galah comes with all this baggage, you know, the flaming galah and the you know, being a stupid galah. I think Bill Shorten used that phrase the other day, but I was being kind of deliberate about that as well. I mean, I'm actually, you know, working with the kitsch and kind of, you know, stigmatized aspect of galahness is kind of important to me as well. But yeah, the problem with the galah was really, really trying. What wasn't working and what was really difficult for me was, like, I wanted to say these kind of larger things about what was going on in the town and these bigger themes, but how can we do this from this incredibly restricted point of view? I mean, Lucky does, she's a very well-read galah, because she goes to the local book exchange and gets books and to tear up and rip to pieces as exercise. But even a well-read galah is still, you know, coming from this very restricted point of view. And then there was this wonderful revelation that kind of came through a chat with a friend, which was like, wow, maybe Lucky's tuning into the dish on the sand dune and receiving the messages from the dish, because the dish has been decommissioned by the time we're, you know, in the present of the novel. It's been decommissioned. It's just a ruin on the sand hill. So it's kind of bored. It's got nothing to do. It did these amazing, momentous, historic things and then suddenly got nothing to do. So it kind of swivels around and turns its attention on the town itself. So it's aware of everything going on in the town, because it's kind of tuning into people's thoughts and everything. I know these sound like really extreme devices for storytelling, but there was something in it for me that having that way of telling the story just took it outside the usual human stories, which was important to me. So having a different point of view, different perspective, is very, I find it very productive. Yeah.
Is that also a way of avoiding that omniscient narrator that always knows everything and who are you? You know, we read and go, who are you? Why are you telling me this?
Are you God?
Yeah. Is that a way of trying to bring them down?
Yeah, it is. It's more emplaced, you know, it's more embodied. It's somewhere. It's a voice that's outside the normal human experience, because it's a galah and a dish. But it's emplaced and embodied. Yeah, you're right. It's not this God voice that's just coming from nowhere.
Well, Ben and I have read it, and we were given the pitch that it's sold by galah, and we went into it going, and we were told by galah, and went into it going, well, you know, with a sort of a, I don't know, it's you kind of get yourself in a position where you're like, well, you could go either way. But the technique works, and I said in a review I wrote, it's difficult now to read a book that isn't narrated by a galah. You kind of need a galah to give you the full story of what's going on. You need that perspective.
That's just so gorgeous. Yeah, you know, that's right. Once we've got a galah narrator, can we ever go back?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about
the
place? Because I've never been there. I feel like I've seen more of it than I've ever probably going to experience.
You grew up in Northwest WA.
That's right. Yeah.
On the coast.
Yeah.
Is that where you're drawing this from? Is it?
Yeah. It's almost an exact steal.
Great.
It's almost a kind of complete piece of theft going on. So I grew up in Carnarvon, which is on the north coast of WA. It's absolutely, you know, really in the middle of nowhere, you know. The nearest town is kind of 500 k's away. You know, it's that kind of remote. It's in the red desert, where the red desert meets the glittering blue Indian Ocean, you know, so that's where I grew up. I've just kind of changed the name to Port Badminton in the novel. If you walked through the streets of Carnarvon, you could probably map where Lizzie and some of these characters are actually walking around the town. So
I actually got onto Google Earth and had a look around. You know, it's quite an amazing looking place.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those places in Australia that offers, if you drive into it or past it, it doesn't offer a lot at first glance to the stranger passing through. People who have lived in Carnarvon and still live there, they talk about how it's the best place on earth to live. You know, and I remember being a teenager when I was, you know, maybe I was about 14 or 15 and someone came back from a trip to Europe, which in those days just felt like this mind-boggling thing to do. And she said, yes, well, I've been to Paris, I've been to London, but the best place is Carnarvon. And I remember I wrote in my diary, really? and I was, you know, as an older teenager, just desperate to get the hell out of there.
And did you just take off straight away?
I did. I mean, I got to the end of year 12. You know, I did the whole, you know, my whole schooling in Carnarvon at the local high school. And then, you know, it was like definitely life is elsewhere. You know, so I was living in books, really. But as an adult, it's like I am just pining for that landscape the whole time. I feel like I'm permanently in exile from the place that where I should be, almost. Wow. You know, so it's a town that doesn't look like much. Yeah, if you Google Street View it, you'll see what I mean. but the thing about it is that you have to make your own life there, you know, like, and we did, you know, everyone who was living there, particularly in the 70s in Carnarvon, you were just like life was a handmade thing. And people had very rich experiences there, lots of adventures, like people endlessly, you know, getting stuck, getting bogged, half drowning, you know, like it was, you know, it's trapped in cyclones. The place is very in the elements, you know, you're constantly in, you know, earth, fire, water.
Yeah, well, that comes across because there are a number of flashbacks to, you know, the cyclones and flooding and also the shift in what drove the economy and the jetty going out of use, and, you know, so big changes going, and the interest in the company, I mean the town's interest in this weird NASA thing coming in from nowhere and suddenly populating the town with these outsiders.
Yeah.
Do things like that happen? Is that part of was there an influx of outsiders that
came
into?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we got to, this totally gives away my age now, but yeah, so I was I was 5 in 1969. So I was born in 1963. So we got to Carnarvon in 1969 and those people were there. So Carnarvon was really going at the time. It was humming, you know, and all these people from all around the world were in Carnarvon, and they were doing all the same things we were doing. You know, they were fishing and getting these giant fish from off the 1 mile jetty. They were, you know, going up to the blowholes. They were doing all sorts of, you know, fabulous outdoorsy things and making the most of it. So it was a very dynamic time. But then they kind of left bit by bit, they kind of left. There was also the OTC, Overseas Telecommunications Commission, there in town as well. But by the mid-70s, people were starting to leave. And there's this poignant thing now where Carnarvon really represents the kind of small town in Australia that is really on the decline. It's really quite sad. The population is declining. When I was there, you know, it was a small town with everything in it. You could buy fabric to sew a dress. You could, you know, go and buy a book, or you could do this or that. Now it's kind of like come right down to just the bare minimal, you know, services in the town. And a lot of people send their kids away out of town to be educated, whereas when I was there, the local high school was a thriving, viable thing. There is this story of decline now. And, yeah, sadly, the 1 mile jetty, which is still there, you can still see it, is just this rotting edifice, you know, slowly dissolving into the sea. Such a historic site, and it's really sad now. Mum and I were visiting it last year, and it's very sad.
Is that when you got the photo of you with the dish I saw on social media?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and but that's the other thing. I don't want to make it sound like Carnarvon's not worth visiting. So I'll just do a little plug for the.
Well, no, because your book is a plug for the place.
It is. It's a love letter to Carnarvon in a way. The dish, I mean, it is a work of fiction, and the NASA and, you know, OTC people who were involved would be just horrified at the technical absurdities that I've created around it, obviously. But there is an OTC dish on the hill just outside Carnarvon. It's this big dish that looks out over the town, and there's now a beautiful little museum under the dish with, you know, like when the NASA people left, they buried things in the red sand dune. Like, it was like, no one needs this stuff anymore, we'll just kind of bury it. And so people have been kind of digging the consoles and all this equipment out of the sand dune and sort of dusting it off and trying to remember what it was and then putting them in this museum. So there's all this kind of Apollo era technology and stuff, you know, in with red dirt on it in this museum. And it's lovely, yeah. So there's... You know, these things are still there in the landscape. If you want to have a look at them,
surely
yeah.
Carnarvon could revive itself just by selling piece by piece on eBay to crazy Americans who are
yeah.
obsessed with the Apollo missions. Yeah. Really pump up
could
the price.
Could be a good
yeah.
idea.
Yeah.
It's probably worth someone coming with a bit more yellow machinery and really going for it. Yeah, because you'd find a lot in the sand.
What about tourism now? I mean, if other industries have sort of left it, is tourism starting to build it?
Yeah, I mean, there is a reasonable tourism thing going, although I must say a lot of people go to Monkey Maya where you can swim with the dolphins, and then they go to Exmouth where you swim with the whale sharks at Ningaloo Reef.
Mm-hmm.
Carnarvon's kind of between these two, and a lot of people just use Carnarvon as a pit stop to get to one or the other of these. But I mean, it has been really sad that the jetty has closed down, because that was a huge tourist attraction. But Carnarvon is increasingly now a food bowl and starting to reinvent itself as, because there's the Gascoyne River there and all the banana plantations and horticulture and everything, and amazing seafood. So you can be in Carnarvon and just have the most amazing food. Local grown food, so it's starting to reinvent itself as a bit of a foodie destination. So, you know, in some ways, like, I'm mournful about the jetty because it's, oh, you know, that's what I remember, but, you know, life moves on and the town is kind of replenishing itself.
Well, you're giving people a reason to stop now. You go from the dolphins to the whales and stop off to talk to a galah.
Yeah, stop off to talk to a galah and have a check out the Dish Museum.
Yeah. I want to go back onto the process of writing, because that really interests me, especially with the bravery of this book and the decisions you've made. How long did it take you to put this together, and what were the things, I mean, discussing things with agents and editors and publishers really brings a manuscript into a whole other place. Was it madder before? Is this less mad than it was, or was there a process to kind of bring it into?
Okay, so in terms of madness level,
yeah.
It was mad, and Peter Bishop at the Varuna Writers Centre really loved it, and anyway, it's all a bit of a long story, but Penguin got it in 2010, I think, and I was given 20 hours with an editor,
mm-hmm.
And in some ways for me that didn't quite work out, because I felt, and this might not be true, there's probably various versions of
yeah.
what was going on, but I felt that I was being encouraged to make it a more conventional story
yeah.
that would be more saleable. And, you know, I would just keep looking back into my heart and thinking, no, it has to be mad. Why do this if it's
yeah.
not mad? So yes, I feel capable of writing a more conventional story, but it's not necessarily what I wanted to do. So it was like, okay, I'll stick to this. So then I had this horrible period of time where it was like it was just being rejected everywhere. You know, the classic story that authors have. So I just sort of was sending it out to everybody and everything, and it was all being rejected. And I was feeling really miserable, and then I got cancer. So you know, we kind of go to the lowest possible ebb in 2014. So you're talking about how long it's taking to write this thing. It's been a really long process.
Very long process.
And then in 2015, when I realised I was actually going to recover from cancer and be okay, I thought, I have to do this bloody thing. And I hooked up with Charlotte Wood, who wrote The Natural Way of Things, and she encouraged the madness. Hallelujah, you know? And so I made it madder. Yeah. It was at that point that I start, you know, getting the galah tuning into the radio telescope dish. I just go for it, you know, forget it. And then that was fabulous.
That something that after you decided it, did you feel like you'd unconsciously been putting a stop on yourself and you weren't going, because of that initial rejection, that you weren't going mad enough and that you were kind of hedging your bets?
Yeah. I mean, it is the endlessly... you know, I mean, there's this whirlwind of creativity that you can do as a writer or artist, and then there's the other side to it, which is what do people actually want to read, and what will people be able to put up with?
Yeah.
So you know, you got to kind of work backwards and forwards in these things. But I know that there's a lot of, I mean, we're using this word mad, and I guess it is mad. It's a form of madness. That there's so much mad literature out there. So I know people do this thing, you know.
Yeah.
So it's obviously possible to do it. And if I'm just going to hang out here and stick to my guns over it.
Yeah.
And I was getting to the point where I was quite happy to... What I needed to do was get it out of my life. It was like this had just been hanging on for too long.
Right.
I just needed to rule a line under it and move on and, like, you know, forget it. So I was on the point of thinking, okay, I'll just put it myself on Amazon and friends and family can download this thing, you know, and I will move on.
Yeah.
But just, you know, literally just kind of at that moment, I was able to get Jacinta DeMacy, who is a wonderful agent. And then she brought it to the attention of Geordie Williamson at Picador, and Geordie loved it. And I think the thing about Geordie is he's from a small town, you know, so it's kind of like I feel it just landed in front of the right people, finally landed in front of the right people to take it to the next spot.
And was this thing, this process, pausing you on any other projects? Like, had this blocked everything else? Did you have to get this out? You weren't writing anything else?
Yeah. What was happening was I'm really interested in documentary making as well, and I teach that at Charles Sturt Uni. So I kind of went off on this whole other jag where I did a feature-length documentary about the sister of Kate Kelly, sister of Ned Kelly,
yeah,
whose name is Kate. So that kind of, like,
Sister
took...
Kate.
Sister Kate, yes. I did a doco about... And it sort of... anyway, it's kind of about her last days in Forbes. So that kind of took enormous amounts of creative energy. So I wasn't writing something else, but I was throwing myself into something else. Yeah, which has kind of left me at the moment with, you know, what is my next thing? What am I doing now? So I've got to think about that.
Well, that probably gives them time because, you know, as I said right from the beginning, you know, this is a unique approach, but it works. Like, it really works. It comes together. And I really think that you actually end up getting people embracing it. When I understand all those issues you had. I mean, I will return to and read bits of Russell Hoban or Kurt Vonnegut or Italo Calvino to remind myself that madness is allowed and that you can go off the path and you can... The writing is really up to you how you do it. People who are, you know, or even just a few fragments of Joyce or something, just to remind you that these things do get and reach people and have a message. I really you know, the layers in this book, I think, would not be possible without the techniques that you've used. And that's the kind of the testament to it. It's not unnecessary. Like, it's kind of necessary to get to where you want to go.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It's when you just sort of write it down in bullet point form, I guess you think, wow, how's that going to work? Or isn't that too gimmicky, too silly? But I guess what unifies it for me is it's all real. So while we're saying mad, on another level, there's a deeper truth there. This is coming from really places deep inside myself. You know, this is my landscape. These are things that were with me, you know, through the formative years of my childhood. And so they're real, you know. They're not just kind of, plucked out of
something. Well, that's the thing. Everything that is, like, the glass experiences, like, you've gone into the glare and you've seen through the cage to look at the people from outside from the glass perspective, and you've thought about that. Then you've got the dish coming in over the top, and it really is observing and reflecting what is going on in the town. So
yeah.
You never really sort of wander into places where people aren't going to understand what you're doing.
No, well, that's right. It's all there. That word containment, or this container, that's something that Charlotte Wood really went on about with me, which was incredibly helpful, which is, a work of art does need a really strong container, and then people are safe and they know where they are. So it's like, yeah, one town, one dish, one galah. You know, like, we've got a tight circle. I remember thinking to myself, okay, it's got to be like a Tupperware container with a lid. Everything's got to be I know this is an odd metaphor, but it works for me. Everything's got to be inside this container. Get rid of everything that's not in it.
Yeah.
You know, whatever that container is. And then, so once you've got the ground rules, you know, you have this sense of containment and logic, and people will go with anywhere with you.
Yeah.
If you set that up, they will go anywhere with you. And I, you know, that's one of the great joys of reading for me has been, you know, that. You know, going off in these weird places with other people's minds, you know.
As long as when I get into something which is different, and as long as I feel that the author has got my hand, you know, in a nice solid grip.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it sends you such confidence.
Yes.
No, this is all my plan.
Yes, that's
once
right.
Once I get that voice and I go, do what you like.
Yes,
I'm with you.
Yes, take me.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. No, I think you're right. Yeah, you've got to be in safe hands. If you, and it's funny the sorts of things that can kind of get in the way of that and then lose you, you know. So it's that safe hands thing is really, really important. And, you know, my manuscript for a long time was a complete mess, you know. And so it might feel at the moment like it's complete and contained, but, you know, the writing process itself was a complete shambles, you know, and that was part of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you've got to hone it down. You've got to wrestle this thing into
and ditch things like, you know, that it's just such a cliche, kill your darlings, but it really is important to just throw things out, even throw out the things that took you there in the first place, you know, they can even go. So it's kind of writing my way into what is this, what have I found, you know, and then everything else can go.
Sometimes I think that's the key to a writer's journey. Once they learn that, that's when they start to write.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're just holding on to all these things which just cause chaos.
That's right, and because they might be well written, you might really fall in love with particular paragraphs and things, and that they stay there forever because, God, they're so gorgeous.
Yeah, and then they all passages.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, no, they're actually the ones that've got to go in the bin.
Yeah, and especially as you said, the initial idea that drew you into the story in the first place, chucking that out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know whether I should admit this, but what I did originally, this novel had, you know, the person a bit like me, you know, going back to the town, walking around the town, blah, blah, blah. That was the device for coming back into the town. And how I'm so glad that got ditched. Don't need it. Lucky is way more interesting than me, you know.
You cut yourself from your own novel.
Okay, yes, exactly right. I had to go.
What is this impediment? Yeah. Something's not right here. Yeah. Oh, it's you.
It's me. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
brilliant.
Yeah.
Tracy, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. We really enjoy this book, and we really hope that everyone takes the plunge and it becomes like us, you know, mournful of books without galah narrators as they go on in their reading life.
That's just too gorgeous. Thank you. That's really beautiful. Thank you so much.
And you can get hold of your copy of The Lucky Galah at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.